right, folks, we are back on the Flagstick.com Tee Talk podcast, and this episode is sponsored by Ping Golf and the all-new Ping G425 lineup. Learn more at ca.ping.com. Stefan Tiedorf here with my co-host, as per usual, and always, the one and only Scott McLeod. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing relatively fine. You?
Pretty good. Pretty proud of that intro, not going to lie. That was smooth. First take, everything.
Getting a little tight on that. I know.
It's only taken me, 120 episodes, two and a half years, and, I can get the intro done first try, so not a big deal. How was your week? Anything new going on in your life?
I'm patiently waiting for a vaccine like you are, but got an appointment, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, me too. Pays to be old, I guess, for you, and pays to have asthma, I guess, for me. There you go.
whatever works. But nothing too drastic. Obviously, a lot of the same conversations over and over again. Seems like Groundhog Day, these days, talking about obviously golf in Ontario, the area we're at. But you know what? There's still lots going on in the golf world around the world. So there's still certainly things to look at, discuss, and talk about. For sure.
Yeah, I was gonna put that as one of my bogeys this week, or an honorable mention, is more on myself, of like getting my hopes up and it being taken away over and over about golf coming back early. I think we've all accepted it's not. We've announced the Flagstick Open will be moved to our secondary date at the end of June there. But it's like one tweet comes out, you're like, oh, I got hope again. And the next thing comes out, it's like, no, it's gone. And then tomorrow, and it's just, it's nonsense. At this point, it's, tell me if it's being extended or not so I can figure out what to do with my life. Everything is like this. Like, we put our boat in this week, and I had to go through like 10 different things to figure out, can I actually use this thing? It's like, yes, you can use it, but not if it parks into a marina. Like, what? Like, none of it makes any sense.
Well, I guess that's been the hard part for the last year and a bit, is just the uncertainty. And I guess the only certainty is uncertainty. So I try not to get myself too wrapped up in it. And I think people probably do themselves more damage from a mental health standpoint, fretting about a lot of things and realizing that, you know what, there's just a lot of things that we personally can't control. The more that you get yourself, keyed up on them, you're just going to cause yourself a lot more grief. So yeah, you just sort of find your way forward like you did with the, find out whatever regulations that you can and cannot do as far as your boat is concerned. Don't get upset about them and just do your thing, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just over it. I want to play golf like everyone else. I just want to go to a driving range. Like, just let me go to a driving range right now and hit a couple balls. I just want to hit a driver. I've told my stories of going to the park and hitting some golf balls, but I just want to rip a driver, and I can't.
Yeah.
I haven't found a field yet that will allow for that without me definitely getting arrested.
Well, the odd side for me is that I obviously, for Flagstick, the magazine, as far as the region is concerned, Eastern Ontario. But Western Quebec as well. So Western Quebec, there's golf going on. So I'm talking to people every day that are playing golf. I'm talking to golf pros that are doing things. Now, mind you, some of their clients are coming from Ontario, and they shouldn't be.
Yeah, so much and for then, the whole border being closed and being, documented and blocked off by, whoever. That really lasted, 24 hours?
Yeah, it's definitely Swiss cheesy, and I certainly say that some people are, definitely getting some tickets if they get caught over there. That is definitely the case. But it's just so odd because there's a lot of people, especially in the Ottawa area, that live or work on opposite sides of the river or whatever the case may be. So we get people that all of a sudden, I live in Gatineau, but I golf in Quebec, or I golf in Ottawa normally. So now they're playing golf, but they're doing Quebec. And so anyways,
there's cottage, right? And then don't have to come back and forth.
Yeah. So there's still golf going on in the world. And I think that's one of the things that, unfortunately, in Canada, we do have, a lot of the golf media are centered in Toronto. So there's a lot of discussion about things that happen there. But, I've been trying to be really cognizant about that, especially in coverage and tweets and stuff in the last little while, just to make sure that, still paying attention to what's going on around the world and around North America. And yeah, it's a big issue. You know, obviously golf for all the golfers here in Ontario, but you know, there's golf going on other places as well. So we got lots to talk about and lots to talk about on this show.
Yeah, let's talk about the golf going on with the week that was. And Scotty, I'll let you pick. Do you want to go on the more positive side or, for the lack of better terms, the crappier side?
Can we mix it up or do we have to start one place or the other?
It was just a pun for me. You know,
I caught that, it's all a
joke. You know, everything is just.
Start with that and start with the fact that why white pants are dangerous.
Yeah, you notice they wore red pants on Sunday at the Walker Cup for a reason. What a crappy experience that was, eh? I don't know what went through the Walker Cup. There were some great tweets of like a guy that, you know, he clogged his toilet and his shower.
Like
clearly something, it wasn't just food poisoning, because food poisoning, you know, you get through it really quickly.
Yeah.
So who knows what happened, but the Walker Cup in overall is my honorable mention. I'm just giving it you know, do we have a term for something like that?
Well, that's the other thing.
So I guess, you know, DNF did not finish, did not even show up. DQ, I don't know what you wanted me to call it, because you couldn't watch it in Canada. You can only watch the replay. You go to watch it, and I'm watching a replay of a Brooks Koepka interview on Faraday from 3 years ago.
Yeah. Like, it was really unfortunate. I mean, there was so much hype for it, and obviously we listened a lot to the American media, and yeah, I was the same. I flipped on Golf Channel in the morning. I was sort of thinking, hey, this is sort of like a, you know, Open Championship morning. I get to watch some matches and some golf in the morning or whatever. And then I'm like, what is this? So, and then, you know, like you said, you can watch the replay later, but the matches are already done.
Yeah,
so,
you know what happened.
Yeah,
the Walker Cup has so much potential. It's obviously it's seminal, where we don't get to see often. The only last time we saw it was that TaylorMade driving for a relief challenge or whatever, and DJ forgot his golf bag a couple times out there, and it was pretty cheesy and hokey. Would love to actually see that course again, but couldn't. I could watch it on replay, but I'm not going to out of spite. Felt for the players. That's a crappy experience. I'm going to kill this pun until there's nothing left in it. You know, to go that for a lot of them, that's the peak of their golf career, whether they believe it or not. Probably everybody on there believes, hey, I'm going pro. I'm going to have a great career. And if you go back, what, three members probably per team actually go on to have a good career. So it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate we couldn't watch it up in Canada. It's unfortunate that was their experience. They battled through, and I would love to see that happen at the PGA Tour level. I don't actually want to see it happen at a Ryder Cup, but there's not a chance those guys go out there at a Ryder Cup. That gets delayed. There's no way they're firing out. DJ walking down there, you know, clinching his butt cheeks, hoping not to let one go. Right, it's just not happening.
No, there's no way, unfortunately. So yeah, moving on. 2 years from now it'll be in St. Andrews, and hopefully they have a better experience then, and hopefully we get some coverage that we can watch live then.
Yeah, I would love that. What's why don't you start with a birdie then for the week?
Yeah, you know what? I stayed up late. I tried unsuccessfully a couple of nights to watch the LPGA event in Thailand. They were delayed by weather in the final round, but Maria Jichanagarn ended up winning, which I thought was kind of cool. I mean, obviously being a Thai player and a win in Thailand, significant, but there was more significance to the win. It had been 1,015 days since her last victory. And then also, you know, she shoots 63 in the final round, wins in her home country, exciting and everything. The other thing is that in 2013, as an 18-year-old, she had this tournament won. She was up by two strokes playing the final hole, and I believe she made an eight and threw it away. And obviously, it was very meaningful for her. So to finally get revenge and, you know, win the tournament, and that's her 11th LPGA win. So that's my birdie of the week.
That is shocking that it's been more than 1,000 days.
It really is.
Because she's always in the mix. I know she had quite the emotional reaction to winning, but also her press conference after, same type of thing, you know, saying she thought about quitting. She says that a bunch, I guess, but you know, it's crazy to think. I don't know how many top tens she had last year, but it felt like she was always in the mix at some points throughout the year, highs and lows. But yeah, nice to see a win. Unfortunate timing where it's just, you know, we're not watching a final round at finishing at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
You and I have gotten up at 3 a.m. to watch an Open Championship, but to stay up is a whole different a whole different thing. So yeah, that was awesome. I like that birdie. I'm also starting with a birdie from a different tour outside the PGA Tour. I'm going to the European Tour, and this Garrick Higo guy. I've gotten up early. You know, it's like Bo wants to get up and just watch some European Tour golf. I remember saying I missed the European Tour back when we were dealing with COVID in the early stages, and they weren't back on for a while. And, right. And these are the types of stories. This kid is unbelievable. 21, decides he has a good lead going, decides, you know what, let's just end this now. I believe it was on the seventh hole. He dunks one for his first hole in one as a professional.
Yeah.
Just, you know, walked away. At that point, it was over. The other two guys he was playing with never had a shot. This guy is going to get into some big tournaments. This is a story that people need to be watching. I was watching him, his last win, I believe, 2 weeks ago. Same thing. I was like, this guy's good. Another lefty coming out of the European Tour, you know, moving his way up world rankings. I don't
Just outside the top 50 right now.
I was going to say, does he have, like, has he got, is he into the PGA Championship or is it too late?
No, I don't think he is. I think he's too late for that, but he's certainly lining himself up for other majors in the year. He's fifth right now in the race to Dubai, like I said, just outside the top 50. So, you know, he's lining up a lot of other majors and major appearances. And that is his third European Tour win in 26 starts, which is incredible. Ties the record that Tiger Woods set on European Tour or PGA Tour. Kid went to UNLV, South African, has a lot going for him. And I get it. You know, a lot of people are like, okay, Tenerife, the golf course was pretty easy, shot 27 under or whatever. But you know what? Major skills, definitely a name you're going to have to get to know very quickly, because he will be showing up, I'm sure, at World Golf Championships and other major championships very soon.
Well, on this trajectory, it'll be in the Masters next year. Yeah. It'll be in an Open Championship, you know, U.S. Open. Like, that's, he'll be in all of them if he stays on this. So, you know, we've seen this happen before with, you know, a bunch of people. I think he's got the game. He's young. Who knows, right? It can happen. You know, you can look at so many different players that, you know, Hunter Mahan, right? On top of the world. Yeah. Now this guy just made his second cut of the year or something last weekend. So who knows where it goes, but I love it. Another lefty out there, you know, outside the PGA Tour. I think, you know, I just want to get that name on people's radar because he's going to pop up and be like, who the heck is this? Yeah. I don't want him to win. And it's going to be a story. Wore the sunglasses the whole time. What are your thoughts on the European Tour's doing the mid-round interviews?
I'm sort of mixed on them. I mean, it's interesting to hear, but I don't know if really the players are that focused on giving an interview in the middle of a round when they're trying to do some things. So I don't know if they're going to get much out of them, maybe entertaining somewhat for the fan. But, you know, I guess if they get used to it, it just becomes something that's normal and they'll probably start to become a little bit more open to it. So, you know, in some cases for some players, they probably want the distraction anyways. They want to be thinking about what's going on. That walk from the tee down to their shot, yeah, just have a chat and give some information maybe, and that would be neat too, is if the questions start to get better and better and a little bit more pointed in the fact that what are you thinking about right now, you know, as opposed to just a general discussion about what the year's been like and whatever, which is what we've seen most of the time so far. What's your thoughts on it?
I'm agreeing with you. I like the idea. I like why they started it, and I think it needs a change. Golf is one of those sports where if Garrick goes, you know, I'm going to take it really easy on this back nine. I'm just going to the middle of the greens. I'm not going to be aggressive at all and then just try to bring it in there. It's not like his playing partner now changes their strategy.
Right. True.
Play it. So you can ask those type of questions where if you go up to, you know, John Tortorella in the NHL and say, hey, what's your strategy for the second period? He's not going to answer your question because that's going to get to the other coach. So, you know, I think we could do way better. You can be more honest. I think it'd be way more entertaining. It's never going to happen on the PGA Tour. I just know that just how they are, but probably will happen on the PGL Tour at some point if that ever gets off. But it seems like that's taking a back seat as some other tour claiming it was their idea first. And, you know, I think that's the PGA Tour has got to be happy to hear they're going back. They're fighting each other out of positioning at this point.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think the PGA Tour has asserted their position. You know, apparently Jay Monahan has asserted to the players that, hey, if you want to make that jump, you're out of here. But, you know,
can you do that, though? Like a lot, like it seems like you throw a lawsuit out there. I saw a quote. What was it? Something along the lines of like there's commissioner Jay Monahan and there's hockey player Jay Monahan. You don't want to meet hockey player Jay Monahan. I think it was Eamon's his article, something along those lines, which means maybe like this guy just like, you know, don't get on his wrong side, or he might like do something, but I don't know. Seems something's going on there. I don't know how much pull Jay really can have in that sense of stopping someone from ever coming back to their tour.
Well, I guess. I mean, in one sense, you know, players, there are a lot of regulations as far as the players. It is their tour. They do own the tour. So, you know, in essence, but certainly a lot of other players are not going to want to see the top players disappear as well, because that makes a difference to their bottom line. So, yeah, we'll see what happens with it. I mean, there's the other side as well. You know, if anybody goes and read Alan Shipnick's article on Fire Pit Collective, if you go and have a look at that, and he talks about the Saudi oil money, and it's a pretty deep article. It's definitely beyond golf. He gets
deep into the pockets.
Yeah, he gets heavy into the political side of it, and you see the entanglement and everything that's involved there. And I think there's a lot for players to think about beyond just the golf and the, you know, making some money. So there's a lot of moral issues and a lot of ethical issues that they have to consider as well. So will they end up, you know, one, happening? Two, will they get the top players? There's a lot of questions there. And really, I mean, you know, as Rory talked about, if you've already got a big structure that's in place that has a historical significance, it's that much harder to make players jump into something that's really, you know, doesn't have any foundation as it is, that, you know, it is a flyer. And if all of a sudden you find yourself on the outside looking in, yeah, it's probably not a great spot to be.
That's true. We can go ahead and do that forever. Why don't we, let's hit our pars of the week. What's your par, Scotty?
Yeah, my par, I mean, par is always a struggle for me. And, you know, I look at it as a yin and yang thing. I try to look at something that maybe, you know, is something I like at some point, but sometimes I don't. And I'm confused by it more than anything. And really,
well, par be a is good par. And then there can be like a three putt par.
Yeah, right? True.
Maybe we can. It's our show. We can change the rules. So maybe you can throw what you want. Is this a good up and down par you're choosing for the week? Or is I hit it in par 5 and 2 and I just 3-jacked from 10 feet.
Yeah, this is more of a 3-jack. I'll call it a disappointing par. And you know, again, this is not, you know, we talked a little bit last week, old media, new media. And this is probably a little bit of bias for me based on my age. I grew up, you know, looking up to certain publications of how they did things, what they wrote, what they published, who the writers were there. And, you know, there's a certain standard that's created. And, you know, my par this week, which will be that three putt disappointing par, has to do with, you know, where Golf Digest and golf.com have gone. And, you know, I get it in a lot of cases that, you know, they're after a different audience and they're a business and they're trying to attract eyeballs, but they really confuse me sometimes. I'll sit there and, you know, flip over to the website. And, you know, I know lots of people that are involved in the operation, younger, older, whatever the case may be, but sometimes there are some great articles. There's some things that are insightful that obviously took some work to go through and, you know, come up with, and you're like, oh, wow, you know what? That's significant. And then there's just crap. You know what I mean? There's just stuff that all of a sudden is, you know, it seems like it's 30 words and it's a topic that, you know, today there was something on about a guy killing a dog on a golf course because the dog stole his ball or something. And it's like, really? I mean, you know, I know they're looking for clickbait and stuff like that to try to attract eyeballs. But, you know, I just wish they'd pick one way, either pick the high road or pick the low road. If you want to be like pure trash or TMZ-ish and, you know, and try to just have as much clickbait as possible, fine, go do that. But if you want to be held up as a standard within the industry, then you're going to have to choose a different path. So I would just say it's a three putt par for me, just more for the confusion's sake more than anything.
Any articles about Paulina doing some wedding dress shopping?
Oh, I'm sure there's a ton on there. Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. That's exactly it, right? Yeah. You're just sitting there going, okay, I get it. You know, you've got a little fun stuff. And we like to have fun on Twitter and social media and stuff too, or whatever, but it's not the essence of what you're trying to do. And yeah, it just seems a little out of character for what there should be in the industry.
All right. I'm okay with that. You would know better. I got no real comments, but I think I made my comments last week with that Patrick Reed article. That was the clickbaitiest of clickbait.
Exactly.
So I see where you're coming from. I'm going with a par this week to the Quail Hollow Golf Course in general. And what I mean by that is I think it's a good course, but it's not a course that I need to see twice in a year. And that's where my head went. And, you know, I heard No Laying Up going on about it a little bit, and they went way more detail. But I kind of just took a step back. I was like, do I really need to see this golf course for a President's Cup? And I know there's details behind it and how they end up getting it, blah, blah, blah. I don't really care. But it's just it's a golf course that – it was okay. Like, it didn't bring a lot of joy at the end. I actually think it's a cool golf course. I think it's fun. It's, you know, perfect condition, you know, the whole nine yards. I think the 18th hole is a great finishing hole and brought a lot of drama this week. It's just, I don't care. It's not a golf course. Like, it can't hold like a Pebble Beach, where Pebble Beach can hold their AT&T and it can hold the U.S. Open 2 months later. Quail can't do that. It just can't. It can't do that. Now, I don't have real thoughts. I want to hear what your thoughts are. Victor Hovland made the comment, is driving range golf out there?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know what? I totally get what he's talking about. I mean, one, the course is made more visually interesting by the use of drone photography. But as we know, you can take a lot of photos with drones and have a 3D image, and it makes something look that much better and have more dimension to it. Having been on the grounds, yeah, there's some cool holes there. Does it carry through on TV? No, I don't think so. I'm with you. There's a lot of holes where I had to, you know, even though I'm familiar with the holes, having walked the golf course, I had to figure out, like, the fifth hole. I watched the replay a little bit last night, and I'm like, is that really the fifth hole? Did they flip the holes? Like, I was sort of confused. So it doesn't have that amount of memorability, and it does for those last few holes, obviously, and that gets played over and over again as far as the green mile and that aspect of it. I will certainly say the finish will be suitable for the President's Cup.
It'll be different. They'll rewrap it. Yeah.
As long as they do some different things with the setup or whatever. But again, it's not a golf course that I'm like, ooh, I have to see that on TV all the time. And man, I wish that was on TV twice a year. Once a year, perfectly fine. No disrespect to the golf course. Fabulous course. Like you said, great condition. Has a few great holes and whatever. But, you know, it's not a barn burner for me.
No, but it did win me a nice bottle of wine, though.
It sure did.
Picking Rory. My other two picks were I went with romantic picks last week. All you three did. Of them were, you know, a little romance behind it. And the one panned out. Rory looked – he looked great. I needed him to just make par on 18 to win a couple dollars for myself. But, it was nice. That, like, when he took that draw, I was shouting out Harry when he's like, no, pitch it. Like, maybe we can pitch it up over here versus actually putting the water in play. And they taste that drop, and it's a horrible lie. That ball is way below.
Well, it's better than the one that it was in.
Of course. Yeah. But way below his feet, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, my good. Like, this is not going to be good. Like, that shot looked so difficult. And I think that this can't be right, but I swear the TV said, like, 190 to the hole.
Yeah, 199 to the hole.
And
then
they said he hit an 8-iron or something like that. I'm like, what?
Just
like
a massive flyer off of where he was at.
That's so, I was just so confused at first. And, big two-putt locks up another win there. You know, that's just like his type of golf course where, he point and shoot. Maybe it was a driving range golf for Rory.
Yeah, you know what? I think what it did, though, is it reasserted our discussion from the previous show. We were talking about Harry being the caddy and the fact that he's not just there to be a buddy. He's an actual caddy. And you know what? He was the one who said to Rory, hey, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't be going towards the fairway. That's maybe not a good choice. Let's consider a drop or hit it up to the left. And again, you know, it's a tough decision. If they'd gone sideways, maybe a different discussion.
Yeah.
But it certainly showed that he had the willingness to step in there and say, hey, you know what? We need to make a choice here. We need to make five. If we make six, we're going to be in a playoff with Abraham Answer, and Scott could win a bottle of wine. So that would be a bad scene. So it was cool to see as far as the relationship and how important it is for a good caddy to be in there and to look at all the options. And yeah, I mean, 8-iron from 199. I mean, that's Rory golf, right? That's decent. And it's good to see.
Yeah. I think this is fair. I'm not one to say when I'm right, right? Like, I don't bring it up too often, or, you know, my accomplishments or anything like that. I'm a pretty humble guy. But I don't think Harry Diamond was the one who convinced Rory he needed to hit a cut because the draw wasn't working anymore. Weird that once he went and saw a golf coach and the golf coach was able to fix it, Harry and him could still get the job done, and it wasn't it wasn't Harry that needed to be eliminated. It's really weird that the player has the most effect on what happens on the golf course, and it's not a correct caddy, you know, one that like, so I mean, just weird. I'm not gonna say names or whoever tweeted that out, and maybe I won't tag you in this after, but just didn't hear anything about that afterwards of Rory needing a real caddy. So overall par for the week. I thought it was great seeing Rory. I want everyone to slow down on him being, you know, the favorite for the PGA championship. I know why that is the case, and we're gonna talk a lot about the PGA
easy
next
storyline.
Yeah, the last time we went there, he won by 22. So, you know, I get why that is the case. We'll get to that next week. We had another tournament to get to, and we got each to give our bogey for the week, and you have an honorable mention to wrap it up.
Yeah, I'll go with my honorable mention, which was a neat story that maybe didn't get a lot of attention. You know, it was mentioned by a few outlets, but, you know, if we go back to the Phoenix Open a couple years ago and the you got this moment with Gary Woodland and Amy Bakkerstedt, who's a Special Olympic athlete with Down syndrome, who's a diehard golfer. A cool thing is she's in her third year at Paradise Valley Community College, which is an NJCAA. So it's a National Junior College Athletic Association school. And they made it into the national championship this week. So she was the first Down syndrome athlete competing in the NCAA event. And it was cool to see, you know, 22-year-old from Arizona. Like I said, a lot of people are familiar with their story from that broadcast. And it was just neat to see. I probably have a little sentimental spot there. I did coach an athlete that came into our club volleyball system with Down syndrome, who was amazing, and I really, really enjoyed it. So it was just nice to see, and it was nice to see it got a little bit of a coverage as well. And she continues to be a shining spot in golf, and I think people love seeing that story. So my honorable mention is an eagle for Amy.
I love that. I think we should have finished with that. But I guess we're going to go with my bogey to finish. Don't know how we're going to transition here. I'm getting a bogey to Brad Faxon's top 10 putters list.
Might not have thought about that one too much.
No. If any list that A has Rory in the top 10 of putters, which is just silly considering, well, like, I get you know, for
he's his putting coach, so what do you expect?
Yeah, that's fair. But the main issue that everyone's pointing out, this is not a new take, is if you have a top 10 putting list and NB Park isn't in the top five, you've done something wrong, right? Like, you've screwed up bad.
Yeah, he clearly should have said if it was going to be the top 10 men, that would have been fine. But when you say the top 10 greatest putters and you all of a sudden don't have any representation by somebody like NB Park, you definitely got issues, and he certainly got the heat for it.
Yeah, I just love it's like, he just posted on Twitter, hope this doesn't get me in trouble, photo like, did anybody ask you for this? Like, hold on, let me, I have nothing to do. I'm just going, scribbling down. Like, what? Like, I was just like, where did this come from? And then, yes, it absolutely did get you in trouble. And don't give me the cancel culture crap on this. That's not what I'm saying here.
No.
What I'm saying here is NB Park is, like, without a doubt, one of the best putters of all time. There's stats out there. I know Rory's, you know, ranked whatever top 40 strokes game putting whatever at times, or he's only done it once. I don't really know. Either way, he's not even in my top 20 if I actually did a list. But here's the thing, nobody wants my list, so I'm not going to do a list. No. Also, just the thing of Jack at six, like how much these are the problem with these lists too. Now I'm going on a whole other tangent. Like, how much of Bobby Locke's game did Brad Faxon watch? You know what I mean? To be like, oh yeah, I got him at five.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, where does he have the information
and
from?
Again, that's the hard part with lists. You're right. He probably never saw him. And hey, all due respect to Brad Faxon, great guy. One of our first guests on the podcast here back in 2019. Obviously a great putter, has turned himself into, a decent coach and obviously has his show and stuff as well. But the problem all the time with, you know, anything that you're going to throw out there on social media, you got to think about both sides of it for sure of what might happen. And that's hard sometimes. You know, we all have blind spots, right? Yeah. So, you throw something out there, oh, top three, and you're thinking in your mind, you know what you're putting out there. So he knew what he was putting out there. He's thinking, oh, these are my top 10 greatest male putters of all time. Whoops, I put the wrong title on it. Well, yeah. Guess what? You just found out you should have changed the title.
So. I'll give him credit, Ben Crenshaw, too. That's a... You know, you could almost put him at one in front of Tiger, but you can't. You just can't.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then we mentioned off the top, your bogey for the week was also the Walker Cup, just being only on in the U.S. and not in Canada. And we didn't highlight that enough, but good bogey. I think we agree. I think it was a good week. There was a lot of good stories, good golf, and we got more golf happening this week. But before we get to it, we have a good interview this week, Scotty. We got Marty Jurtsen finally from Ping.
Yeah. Yeah, solid one. Marty's the VP of fitting and performance. Brilliant guy. Always has some neat stuff to pass on from a wisdom standpoint. And I think people see this in this interview too. It's not just about golf. There's some things that, you know, just the way he thinks, being an engineer, but also being a massive golfer as well. He's just got some cool stuff. And I think people will really enjoy this interview.
I agree. One of his favorite quotes, he says in this interview, you're going to know it, I hope, when you hear it. Mm. And I got it. If you're, we've added a little more social element to our social media page, our Tee Talk podcast on Instagram. Make sure you go follow it. And I got his quote behind me on that. It's something I'm trying to remember. And we'll talk about it after we get back from the interview. Before we get to the interview, a quick message from our episode sponsor.
At Ping, our culture of curiosity has been driving innovations for over 60 years. Innovations like the new G425 iron, which brings you greater distance without sacrificing the forgiveness and control you need to play with precision. And with free access to the Arcos Caddy system, you'll play smarter and shoot lower scores. The new Ping G425 iron, better by every measure. Get fit today.
Visit ca.ping.com to learn more about G425.
All right, we want to welcome to the podcast Marty Jurtsen, one of the smartest guys in golf. He'll probably blush when I say that, but Marty obviously he's the vice president of fitting and performance for Ping Golf. A lot of people are fairly familiar with him, not only on Twitter and because of his work with Ping, but other work as well and his playing career. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Scott, for having me. Yeah, I don't know. I'm in a weird place where I'm just working on a little bit of everything these days. And it's kind of fun to be at this point in my career to just kind of follow curiosities. And it's what's been great about Ping. And it's kind of, a big company that kind of still feels entrepreneurial. Like, you know, Karsten, his soul is still with us every day when we come in the office. So it's just fun to be part of the culture here.
Yeah, we had Ryan Stokey on before, and we really talked to him a little bit about the engineering DNA of Ping, and that probably attracted you as well to the company when you started, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I graduated college and got my mechanical engineering degree, I mean, designing golf clubs is the ultimate. It's kind of the ultimate thing you can't learn in school. Like, it's only done through an apprenticeship, right? Like, you need to have kind of engineering skills, you need problem solving skills, but you have to have massive creativity. And so I learned it on the job. You know, you come in with potential, and then you kind of learn under others and through apprenticeships. And so I think now Ryan and myself, we're trying to mentor those that we've hired and that are bringing up, and certainly some of the engineers that you know, I've hired and they work for me is, have far surpassed my design and engineering skills. And thank goodness, because now I get to enjoy the benefits of their designs. Corey Bacon being one of them, who's one of our lead designers and designs a lot of our blade irons and things of that nature, is also a fantastic player. I mean, his design skills are through the roof at this point.
Yeah, I mean, to carry through on that, you know, when we talk about fitting, that's obviously, you know, a key part of that golf equipment history for the company. And, you know, Ping was obviously an innovator. And, you know, just like I said to you before we came on here, I got a 2006 fitting guide but for Ping sitting right here. But, you know, the company's emphasis on fitting goes back decades before that. And, you know, they were a leading company regarding that. Was that part of the excitement for you, too, in getting involved with them?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, you know, when you look at the fitting side, it's, I've tried to take a problem solving approach that we take in the design world, which is really, you know, what problem are we trying to solve and how can we have authentic solutions that are really motivated by helping golfers play their best? And that's at the core of what we do on the design end. I think it's, candidly, it's at the core of what we do on our customer service and that side of things. But yeah, definitely now we're trying to really reinvigorate that on the fitting side and bring, you know, bring the right type of innovation to that space. And again, I mentioned Karsten before, but, you know, that's what that was like a foundation and a principle that he brought to the entire golf marketplace. And so we're trying to double and triple down on the fitting side and help people play better golf through better designs and better fitting. And when you can do both, that's the ultimate, that's the sweet spot. That's the holy grail.
I think that's one of the coolest things about Ping is everyone knows Ping's objective. It's out there every time, every commercial, Ping, play your best, play your best, play your best. And it's what brought me in. I don't bring this up too often on the podcast, but I was the 2014 Ping Fitter of the Year here in Canada. And I think that's why I was so caught off, you know, bought into it is the why. You start with the why at Ping always. And even when you're doing new product designs, if you know the why is, can we beat the last one? And if not, why are we putting something else out if we can't do it? Is that still like a philosophy you hold true to yourself and make it such a mission every single day to be better than the day before?
Yeah, I mean, it honestly is. I mean, it's we've talked about this a little bit at Ping before, but you know, our marketing comes on the back end. You know, we design the product, we define the problem we're trying to solve. You know, which aspect of helping a golfer play better. And then that helps us define the technology that we work on, the R&D we do, you know, and then we you know, the marketing comes in at the end to help tell the story of how we do it, where certainly a lot of other companies, for right or for wrong, there's the different, you know, kind of the marketing's at the beginning. Like, here's a cool story to tell, develop a technology behind it. And so, you know, I think there's been some companies in the industry that now aren't in the industry anymore because, you know, they probably had that approach and we're performance first, player best first, and telling the story comes on the back end.
I think the other thing that Ping does so well too is it's a family. It's once you're in, I feel like you're in for life, whether that is even from a consumer standpoint, but definitely from a, you know, if you work for Ping, it's rare you hear people leaving Ping. Why is that from your perspective?
Yeah, it is a family. I think it's, you know, there's this quote I heard recently that being ethical is long-term greedy. And it was like, I was like, man, oh man, that really hits home here at Ping. I don't know if anyone has decoded that, but I think it explains a lot of what the family does. And so that's why people stick around for a long time. I mean, the family takes really good care of its employees. We all feel like a family. People say, what's the favorite part about working at Ping? I always say, well, my coworkers and my colleagues, we all share the similar passion for what we're trying to do. I just went to, right before I jumped on the pod with you guys, a retirement celebration for one of our employees that was the assistant to our president here, Marie Conser, 32 plus years. And sure enough, at the celebration, we got employees down there that have been here for 40 years, you know?
So it's pretty incredible. Pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's great in the Ping book that Jeffrey Ellis did that came out several years ago, all 9 pounds of it. There was a lot of family stories, and there was a lot of things there about the employees that people would never know about, whether they were in the office doing accounting, whatever the case, they were included and being, you know, they were emphasized as being just as important as every engineer, everybody else in the company.
Yeah, that's why our company meetings are so fun to get our big mix, you know, because we have so much manufacturing. We got, you know, the accounting jobs, the marketing jobs, engineering jobs, the techie jobs, and then all the manufacturing jobs. Everyone's there together. Recently, it's been fun because we've all been mixing it up down there in production, building clubs. Obviously, we're so busy. All of us have been down there. I mean, John Kay, our president, is down there all the time, loft and line. He's down there more than any of us. That's not just a media piece. He is down there. Trust me. He's down there more than me, building clubs. So it's been good for camaraderie, you know, lately, especially, but, yeah, it is a tight knit group and we all love what we're doing here and committed to our mission.
Yeah. The last time I was there, we were doing the training in that, you know, that little, what would you call that? You know, that little classroom on top of the main building there. And John pops in. He's like, anyone show you the office yet? And no. So he pulls us out and we're in the middle of something. And, you know, the teachers are like, you know, we got to finish here. What's going on? But hey, he's the boss. So we're going through the office. And when we had Ryan on, I asked them the same question. So he opened up the closet there with all the old clubs in there. That was one of the coolest moments. There's a couple guys, I think you were actually there that day, they were like, I've worked here for 10 years. I've never had the guts to ask about opening that closet or seen inside. Yeah. Have you seen inside that closet of all the old gear and all the ideas that it were in Carson's head over the years?
Yeah. You know, we have a historian here who, we have him present to our engineering group once every quarter at our quarterly meeting. And he tells, you know, one of those little stories that, again, nobody really knows about Carson or why he did something a certain way, or a story about, you know, Carson and his kids, you know, doing aerodynamic testing, driving down the middle of the desert before everything's here, and they're holding clubs up and see which one bends the shaft more. And so, yeah, it's fun. We need to ask those questions and tell those stories around. But that closet is really neat. And, you know, candidly, we get some great design ideas coming out of there. One of our latest things we did was, you know, Carson knew about pistol grips and what they did in putting before any of us. And so now, you know, we find ourselves doing a lot of research that explains just what he already knew. And we went in there and saw some of these pistol grips we were working on. We did a big project on why that works and where it points your hand. And we found some old videos of him talking about exactly the physics behind that he had the foresight and the intelligence to think through before we could even do it with a big team of us, you know, so.
That's wild when you think about it. I mean, you know, you can look to the past, obviously, for a lot that you're going to do in the future. And, you know, you guys are doing a lot of things right now of heading into the future and adapting to what's going on in the market these days. And one of the things I think that's come to attention is this telefitting program that you guys have been doing. And, you know, obviously it's been difficult for people to get to locations to go through a fitting process. But you know, you guys are actually saying, hey, you know what, we've got all sorts of tools. Let's engage ourselves in this. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the program and how it works?
Yeah, definitely. This is fun. You know, obviously, unfortunate with the situation we're all in, and up there, you guys are in it a little bit more than we were now, and the timing is a little bit different of some of the constraints and restrictions. So it was about a year, maybe last March or April down here in the U.S., we spun up this telefitting process, and that was the whole idea. Hey, people are stuck at home. We got fitters that are skilled. We got tools. You got Zoom. Let's connect dots here. Let's help people out. Let's connect our fitters with customers directly. We're not going to mislead people and say this replaces the in-person dynamic fitting. We're going to tweak your angle down the nearest half degree. We're candid about that. But if somebody knows their angle, they've always been blue for a long time or whatever, you know, we don't need to, you know, necessarily go through that. And maybe they have some launch conditions. Maybe they can send us a video of their swing and their putting stroke, or they have some iPing data. Let's connect. And a lot of times you can do a lot through just talking things through. And we've developed so much software in the last couple of years. So one of the big things my group on the fitting side has done, and a lot of these tools are internal to Ping. Some were starting to trickle out and get to accounts and to our fitters. But we have so much we can do on the software side to fit folks. We can do advanced set gapping and set configuration. We can help you fit the right golf ball to your game now, which is really unique. We can determine optimal launch conditions on your driver. We can talk about your irons. We can look at your putting stroke. If you have any eye ping or putting stroke data, we can make really good recommendations there. So we use a lot of our software tools to help talk through the customer. We do it all through a screen share. So it's not just a phone call. We share the screen. We share our tools. We can talk back and forth, kind of use our WebFit tool as kind of our base. But then we have a lot of other internal tools that we use. And it's been great. Our fitters have loved it because they get to connect with customers and face-to-face, sort of, like we are. And golfers who are stuck at home or constrained have loved having that outlet to be able to talk here. And in a lot of cases, we can configure some nice stuff and make some good recommendations or give the golfer a starting point. Hey, when things open back up, here's your jump start. You're 90% there. Go try these two shafts and see which one works best for you. Go, hey, we're real close. We're here on head model. Try these two and these two color codes and hopefully jumpstart things when things open up.
Yeah, obviously that's an evolution of what's happening as far as, fitting is concerned. You know, consumers obviously have more access now to launch monitors, data, things that they can provide you for feedback, which, they didn't have 5 or 6 years ago. Where do you think that's headed? Obviously you're heading in a certain direction here. And as you said, it's not a full replacement for what you normally recommend as far as a fitting is concerned. But where do you think fitting is going and what other things do you think will come into play that will help fitting in the future?
Yeah, I think the place to look for where fitting is going is the PGA Tour. Like whatever the PGA Tour has now, golfers will have in 10 years. Like your average person will have 10 years from now. Right. So PGA Tour players fit, have access to shot link data, mm-hmm. and they have coaches or statisticians like us and my team, data scientists, helping look at their courses. We can tell a player which courses to play, which suit their game the best to maximize their earnings and their results. Right. We have that level of intelligence and nuance with all the data they have. Your average golfer doesn't have that, but guess what? In 10 years, they're going to have it. We already have millions of shots for ping users who use Arcos, and we can data mine it. And we're starting to develop, it's still relatively early days, but that level of intelligence of looking at how somebody plays golf on the golf course, what their real trends are once they go play. This has always been part of our fitting process. Go play, measure results. We used to have this little scorecard, come back and tweak your line goals. I mean, we are so far past that, it's not even funny, but we're doing the right thing, which is your fitting does not end at your fitting. Real tour fitting is never ending. And so I think the future of fitting is never ending, continuously looking at your on-course data, your trends as your swing or your speed evolves, and tweaking and titrating to that performance. And so we're building the tools and the infrastructure to help support that mission, that vision.
So being the VP of fitting, are you the hardest person to fit for yourself, or do you know I've built such a good team, I can just hand it off and I'm going to trust them. But if it just came down to you, just you fitting yourself, is that a very difficult thing for you to do?
Yeah, I honestly, one of the best things I've done is I never try to fit myself. I outsource my fitting. I toggle my golf brain into just, hey, I usually go to one of our tour fitters or our master fitters here, fit me like you don't know me, I'm coming off the street, and throw the book at me. I got no affiliation with Shaft or whatever or whatever, so just fit me. And that actually works really well. Our tour fitters especially, they're so nuanced with working with our PGA Tour players and kind of those little fine-tuned details there. And honestly, that's what a lot of the things I learned from are from the tour fitters and our master fitters. And we try to bake those processes down, simplify them, and deliver them to our account fitters and information that we give to our customers.
I love it. You brought up fitting for a golf ball. And every time I talk about ping and fitting and ping being, the top of the line equipment, everyone always asks me, why don't they make a golf ball? And they have in the past, obviously, and you have in the past, but in your own words, why doesn't Ping still make a golf ball, believing in the engineering department they have?
Yeah, we certainly have a lot of expertise in aerodynamics and flight, but I think I think balls would be, you know, commercially might be challenging to kind of break into that and make a dent. You know, I think that the competition is so intense and so fierce in that space. So, you know, instead of trying to make golf balls, we've instead turned our brain power, collective brain power here into how can we properly fit the golf ball with the club, right? And this is, we're in a place in golf history where balls have never been so different. You can have balls that are high spin and they fly low outdoors, low spin, they fly high outdoors. You know, some spin a lot around the green, some don't. They have different feel when you're putting. Aerodynamically, the flights are very different. They can be different in the wind and those type of things. So we've turned our research and our focus into how can we fit club and ball synergistically to the golfer. And again, this is what the tour players do. And so we're building the tools to pass this tour level of expertise and nuance and intelligence right to the end golfer. And that's what we're on the road to do.
So the golf ball obviously has been in the news a lot lately. And, you know, your Twitter bio says distance maximizer, score minimizer. Now, what are your thoughts about all the talk about the golf ball and rolling it back? I know from a equipment standpoint is probably not something that is the most fun thing to think about, but you know, what are your honest thoughts about the game of golf with that idea in mind of rolling the golf ball back?
Oh man, I tell you what, I mean, the thing that's in the psyche of everybody when you talk about rollback is just the concept of loss aversion. Like you can cap something in the future and we'll be creative to find ways to kind of enhance performance or enhance the custom fitting. But anytime you take away something that someone already has, you know, I mean, we've all learned this lesson as parents, you know, it's like the loss aversion is what hurts. So nobody wants something taken away from them that they already have. So I'm fine capping something in the future, no problem, you know, but that's the part that, you know, I think it's going to, you know, rub people the wrong way and in the psyche of human beings, the wrong way is that loss aversion piece. But so I don't know. I'm not excited about that. I'm excited. I think golf's in a great place. Don't mess it up. You know, let's just double down. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. Obviously, you know, everybody enjoys the game and, you know, as you said, taking something away from it is probably not going to get anybody too excited about it. No. We want to be excited about the game. One last thing as far as from a fitting and perspective in talking about the tour stuff, you know, obviously your end of it, what you're dealing with all the time, you know, the engineering team there, which, you know, met lots of them there and you do some amazing stuff. Are there certain players that you guys interact with? And I won't say that are, you know, the most fun to fit, but are there certain players that really get into the data and get into what you guys are doing and really, you know, have a different appreciation for that?
Yeah. That's a good question. Yeah. Some of our tour reps, like on the LPGA tour, Scott Wolpa, he's our rep. And so he's had a good time deep diving some things with some of our LPGA gals, getting into the weeds on some of the data and the stats. And we're helping them with figuring out wind and elevation and ball and gapping and some of those things. On the PGA Tour, I would say, you know, Stuart Sink's been really fun to have on staff. I think we've had him, you know, it's been in the news how much further he's hitting it. A lot of it's from our optimal launch and spin driver chart, getting his angle of attack up more, fitting him more optimally for his driver. And how can somebody hit it further if they're swinging at the same speed? Well, it's called fitting and, you know, some aerodynamic improvements. So that was fun to see. Louis's fun to work with. He likes to change clubs a lot, but we can learn a lot from him and his level of nuance and feel. One of the guys who was most into the data, he's sort of retired now, was Daniel Summerhays. I mean, he was kind of, he was the one that was thought most like an engineer. And, you know, he worked with some techie coaches, Grant Waite and Dana Dahlquist. These guys really thought very technical about the swing. So I really liked working with Daniel. He was the most technical when it came to asking questions and why things happen and into the nitty gritty and the weeds.
And who was the complete other end where it was just like, just give me whatever.
Yeah, I mean, some guys just hit it so good it doesn't matter. I mean, like Miguel Jimenez. I mean, it's not that he doesn't care about how it performs. He can literally just flush anything.
Now, is it true with him? My understanding is when his contract was up, he didn't even look at it anymore. It was just like, send me whatever and I'll sign it.
That's pretty much what I've heard. Yeah, I think what I heard from our old head of tour is he would call up Miguel, time to do the contract, you know, he'd get it in the mail or whatever, however he'd get it. And he goes, okay, boss, that was it. There it is.
Crazy.
Bubba's got the lifetime contract now. So
yeah. Do you think you have a little bit of an advantage, though, too, you know, from an engineering standpoint by being a player, you know, PGA of America member, played in, you know, major championships. Unfortunately, didn't have the greatest finish in Florida this year. Sorry, I didn't want to bring that up. But, you know, does that, do you think, give you a little bit of different insight?
Yeah, I think I view my job as, you know, to take those on-course experiences and bring them right back into the office and act on them, right? Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to eliminate friction points or pain points to the golfer. And when we're talking about our tour players, if you're designing golf clubs, you're not a golfer yourself. You have to develop those empathy skills to be that player. Well, not just myself, but, you know, Corey, Travis Milliman, Matt Simone, we got all these guys on our team. They play in USGA mid-ams, four ball championships. They're on TV and winning state ams by 10 shots last year. So all these guys can play. We're all really tight together in terms of our skill here. And that we make sure we use what we're experiencing on the course and bring that into the office to act upon. I mean, consistency is the perfect example. Down there in Florida, there's one hole. It's like 270 carryover bunker, little into the wind. But if I hit a good three wood, it's getting over no problem. It's maybe 265 carry down there. If I had a good three wood into the wind, it gets over no problem. That third round, I swung, I thinned one big time with my three wood. I was like, oh no. Then I was like, oh wait, I got consistency. That thing flew over that bunker, no problem, right? If I had any other fairway wood, that thing's going right in there. So that's a real life example. We take that pain from, I don't want to thin my fairway woods in the wind. It's terrible. And we bring it into the office and we engineer a solution for it.
It's amazing. I want to talk about your golf game, but before we do, I have one last thought about, you know, your job that you do every single day. And now when you go to those major championships as a player, how hard is it for you to turn off, you know, the VP of fitting and performance when you're, say, hitting balls with Side Bubba on the range, who you probably have a personal relationship with? And, you know, how's that three-way? Like, can you actually balance the two?
Yeah, I've been so lucky to play in more than one. I mean, I'm playing in one is a dream come true. I mean, now I'm at six or whatever it is. It's the first couple, that was a lot harder. And I was a lot more nervous about just literally everything. You know, what if I play bad or shoot a million? Well, I did that a few times. It turned out nobody remembers. So then lately, the ones I've played in the last few years, 2019, 2020, I have been able to do that and be a little bit more focused on, hey, I'm here to play golf and I'm more relaxed. I'm not nervous around the guys. Somehow last year at Wingfoot and Harding Park, somehow I ended up hitting balls next to Tiger literally every time he hit balls on the range. So, that was fun, as well. So the last couple of years, it's been more relaxed and more fun. And, you know, I played with Victor Hovland, the Phoenix Open last year, January 20. Sure. You know, then I see him at Wingfoot and in Harding Park last year. We're just shooting the breeze like we're, just old best friends. So it's super fun.
What did in 2019, you made the cut at the PGA Championship and, yeah, you know, you talked about it on Twitter being, you know, almost a dream of yours, but like, what did that mean to you? Obviously, you know, that's the goal once you get there, right? When you're there, it's like, yeah, I probably am not going to win this knowing who's around here, but like, that's the goal. And you finally, you know, broke through after being there quite a few times and made the cut. So what did that mean to you?
That was the ultimate. You know, if I never play another tour event again, I mean, that's definitely the pinnacle, playing the weekend in a major. Because once I got in that first major and played my first couple, I was not proud. Like, I didn't play the game I knew I was capable of. And so that was like then my motivation. Like, man, if I get another one of these things, I got to time it out. Play the game that I know I'm capable of, not only for me, but all the PGA members that are in there. And you go so many years, oh, none of them are going to make the cut or whatever. Well, that year we had three of us make the cut. You know, we were all in there kicking butt and doing good. And so Yeah, that was the funnest golf moment for me in my life, was walking down that 18th hole at Bethpage. Sun's going down. I'm at my wife and my family are there with me, my best friend with my caddy, caddying for me, and just walking down. I hit the fairway on that 18th hole at Bethpage, and, there was no screwing it up from there. I mean, it was a done deal, and that was the most magical moment in my golf career, walking down that fairway in the second round, knowing I'm going to play the weekend with the big boys.
That's awesome. Where's your game at right now? Obviously, you know, U.S. Open qualifying is going on. You played in it last year, still planning to do some qualifying this year. And how do you feel about your game right now?
Yeah, my game has a lot of potential. I'm driving it better than ever. And that's like the base of good golf is driving. And then I'm the rest of my game is a little volatile, but driving is the most important part. I think it's easy to get the other pieces into shape. And so I took like 5 months off this winter. I got a little toasted out from Wingfoot last year, and I spent a lot of time with the family and kind of my own version of hibernation. But then I practiced really hard for a couple of weeks for my tournament last week. Obviously, almost got in the PGA, came really close there. I'll be playing in U.S. Open qualifying next week, our locals here. And then hopefully if the restrictions are all off, I'll go for the British Open, the Open Championship. I'm in the final qualifying. It's called LFQ, or local final qualifying. And I'm going to go over to West Lancs in England and try to get in. I lost in a 5-hole playoff there in 2012. So now my new goal is to play in the British Open. So that's what I'm doing this year. I'm working towards that. Working on my win game, links game. I love links golf. I really do. And I've done pretty good over there. So that's kind of my focus for this year.
Nice. Obviously, you know, just in having this conversation, you're talking about wearing a lot of different hats as far as, you know, your work at Ping, playing wise and stuff. You've got another hat you're wearing, doing some work with a fellow Canadian of ours, Sasha McKenzie, in a project, the Stack System. Pretty cool stuff. Obviously, getting a lot of attention right now. Can you explain a little bit of the genesis of it and what it is, and why everybody should be maybe paying attention to it?
Yeah. So Sasha, man, he's a good guy to know, obviously. Guy is so smart in so many different avenues, biomechanics and training. And I've been lucky to have a direct line to him. You know, a couple of years ago, my back hurt. I'm slow on distance. I'm like, Sasha, help me out. You know, so he's helping me with a weightlifting programming. And it's so technical on how he did it. Do this progression this many days, rest this time, do this, do that. I just followed his prescription. And sure enough, this, you know, 4 months later, I'm like deadlifting triple what I was, and my back feels great, and I'm hitting it further. I'm like, this guy's a magician, you know? And so he had this idea to do a similar thing, but for speed training. So golf speed training is totally different than strength training. So they have some similarities, but totally different. So he had this concept, hey, let's have a speed training thing, all these adjustable weights, and let's make an app and coach people through it. And so sure enough, we got it done and we launched it. So the stacksystem.com, and that's Sasha's basically brains and intelligence are in the app. Everything he would do training his tour players is available to you now. You know, you saw all the intelligence is in the app. It scales from juniors, 10 and up. You can be a lady, you can be a senior golfer. The weights all scale appropriately. You could be a long drive driver using this thing. And so it's all based on the, sports science of training a certain percentage of your club head speed faster than you can normally do, and then a certain percentage slower. And the app is always looking at your speeds, and it's titrating with a lot of precision because we've got 30 combinations of weights. It's titrating those weights so you stay a little bit over, a little bit under perfectly. There's a bunch of different programs, even single arm programs. He's seen some golfers. He's worked with one tour player that he's unlocked a lot of distance because his trail arm was a lot slower. So you can do like a right arm only program and unlock some speed. So yeah, it's a hardware software solution. You need a little speed radar to track your speeds. The app's really cool. You can talk your numbers into it so you can interact with it hands-free while you're training. Stores all your data in the cloud. There's like a coach's solution so you can be a coach and see how your students are training. There's cool algorithms. Grit score is a score in there that shows you or your coach like how well you're sticking to the training. It's like a compliance score. That's my favorite. So, yeah, we did all the math and algorithms on that. So it's been a lot of fun. Yeah, Sasha was having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I guess they can roll the golf ball back, but if people are keeping coming up with these type of things, like we're just going to catch up anyway. So what's the point? Why hurt the golfers and take stuff away when we have all these different tools to make you hit it further and play your best? Marty, we really appreciate you coming on the Tee Talk podcast. Appreciate Ping for sponsoring this episode, and hopefully you can come on again. And good luck over there overseas, getting into your first British Open. And if you do, we'll make sure we give you another call and talk about that experience.
Oh man, hopefully let's pencil that one in. Let's do it.
The Tee Talk bump's coming your way. All right, Marty, we appreciate it.
Boom. All right, thanks guys.
Thank you, Marty, for that interview. I thought it was, educational. I thought it was entertaining. A lot of history about Ping, why we both love Ping and the company they are and the technology. But, just nice to hear a guy that is that smart, as you heard from start to finish, that's also just such a good golfer and just loves the game too. And as I said, that quote that he mentioned, being ethical is long-term greedy, that put both you and I, our heads spinning for a couple days after. It's been in my head, just doing the right thing off the bat will help you more in the long term. If you couldn't figure out exactly what that meant, but love that interview. I could have Marty on every single week.
Yeah. Smart guy, but a humble guy as well. And I mean, for a guy who's so immensely talented, and that's great to see, and that makes him, one of the most sought out interviews in the industry for that. And then obviously, he's got his other partnerships with, Sasho and doing some other things as well. I mean, people want to collaborate with this guy, just because he is such a great guy. So we're really happy that he was able to come on and share some of that, wisdom with our audience.
I loved it. We have more Canadians getting into the U.S. Women's Open here, Scotty. Brooke's not the only one. It's starting to fill up.
Yeah, the qualifiers are taking place. And, obviously the U.S. Women's Open this year is happening at the Olympic Club, which is fabulous in San Francisco.
It's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, great golf course. Obviously has hosted some, U.S. Opens and U.S. amateurs and a memorable golf course. So it's great to see that the women in the USGA are going there. Brooke was in the field based on her performances, obviously. Hopefully at some point, I think Elena's qualifier is coming up, if it has not happened already, but I think it is yet to come up. But we've got three other Canadians that have joined her already. Noemi Pere, who's an amateur, got in there and that was fabulous to see. Megan Osland, who's a pro lefty out of Kelowna, got in there as well. And then yesterday, Rebecca Lee Bentham managed to qualify, shot 500, and then got into playoff and birdied the first two holes of the playoff, I hear, and made her way in there. So we have at least four Canadians to cheer for the U.S. Women's Open this year, and hopefully we have a few more in the days to come.
Yeah, well, we'll keep knowing. There's a lot of U.S. Open stuff coming on. You see Mark Anguiano shot 9-under to get through local qualifying. Like, I feel like at that point, they should be like, just you're in.
Like, just, it would be nice. Yeah. I mean, it's such a big process. I mean, the women obviously have one level. They had about 1,600 competitors that, that entered qualifying. The men end up usually around 9,000 players try to get through. So they have a local and sectional qualifying. So it's a little harder process to get through. We have a few other Canadians as well that have already gotten through the locals. But yeah, with a guy like Mark, you'd almost think, if you set a certain standard, hey, if you win by this much, you get you get the golden buzzer and you get to go all the way to San Diego and get to Torrey Pines, you get in. But again, that's the hard part of open championships. There's a lot of great players trying to qualify, but great to see Mark shoot that 63 and push his way into the sectionals.
Now, speaking of Canadians, Corey Connors, so I don't text this guy often, but it's more and more because every time I shoot him a message, it's just because he got another hole in one.
Yeah.
And that's my third this year, basically, where I've messaged him. So I just said, I only text you when you get a hole in one. Congrats. He says, thanks. I go, how many is that for you? It's got to be at least 10. He said, I think 11 now, starting to lose track. So he's starting to lose track. That's tough. So we want to keep, I told him, we're going to keep him him in our thoughts, that he's losing track of how many hole-in-ones he's had. Holes in one, I don't know, whatever it is. 254-yard par three.
I know, crazy.
And never saw it on TV. Nope, didn't. No. Just couldn't throw it on one time in the broadcast. What was up with that?
Well, you know, he was playing a little bit early.
He was sweeping some dew, that's for sure.
Yeah, but you know what? Another donut. They rocked out the donuts in Listowel again. The special Corey Connors hole-in-one donut. They brought it back out in honor of that. And you know, if he keeps this up, they're just going to have to make it a permanent part of their menu down there.
Yeah, for sure. All right, now we got the Byron Nelson down in Dallas this week. Shout out to Bryson, who flew back to Dallas and right back to the golf course. Hero move. And then decided to talk about how expensive it was. I think he should have had to fly commercial back.
Commercial? I know.
Yeah, I should have made him fly commercial. That would have been great. Like, oh, like NetJets just like, nah, can't get you a flight back. Sorry. But he's back home now playing. Is he playing even in this tournament?
He's got to be in his backyard. Yeah, he is in the field.
There he is. Okay, cool. Brooks is back in the field too. After his long day, his long time off there, you know, I think he's just trying to get ready for next week's PGA Championship and test out the knee. But DJ, who does like to play the week before majors, not in the field citing a knee injury. How many words of that statement that came out do you think he actually wrote? Because I'm going with
the zero. Big zero. As Matt Blois would say at THG, zero.
Yeah, it was not even close. It was like none of that DJ would ever say. So unfortunate that that he's not going to be there. Other kind of different story. Jordan Spieth picked up COVID-19 on the break, and that kind of swept under, like, so much going on at the same time. Like, how is a guy like Spieth, I mean, and maybe it's a choice, but like, how does he not have his vaccine at this point? Like, Dez walked into a grocery store in the States and picked it up. Like, maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's a choice, but it's a stupid choice if that's his choice.
Yeah, I don't know what the deal was with that. I mean, he said he was surprised, you know, that he picked it up. Who knows, whatever the situation is or whatever. But you're right. You'd think at this point, based on the number of people in the U.S. that are vaccinated or at least have had, you know, one shot of their vaccine, that he might, you know, again, that doesn't guarantee, you know, that you'd be safe from it. But yeah, it's kind of surprising to see it happen. But he says he's okay now and he's back at it. And obviously, you know, again, an important week for him, especially in the Dallas Metroplex, in his home area, to be there and to play. And like you said, to get ready for the PGA, which is what a lot of other players are trying to do.
Yeah, so this is a new golf course. Am I not correct about this tournament?
Well, not new to this tournament.
Yeah, sorry, I mean, it's been the tournament, yes.
Yeah, it's been, you know, it was at Trinity Forest the last 2 years, and then they moved it over to TPC Craig Ranch. I mean, again, this is sort of the move for the PGA Tour, is trying to move it over into more TPC properties, good or bad. You know, this is a property that was used for the Korn Ferry Tour Championship in 2012. I think about 16 under won that. I think it was Justin Bolli who won that. That's a little deep as far as research is concerned, but so it's not an unfamiliar golf course. Same turf conditions and things as Trinity Forest. A little bit not as roomy as Trinity Forest, but it all puts the players in a situation that, you know, probably the Dallas-based players will have had some familiarity with this golf course. I believe it's been used as well for Q schools also. So, you know, some players will definitely have to be getting used to this golf course in the first few days, while the Dallas-based ones will probably have some experience with it.
For sure. What's more surprising to you, John Rahm being tied for the favorite to win this, or Daniel Berger being the fourth favorite? Like, that's crazy how far Daniel Berger's come in his career, that he's like every tournament top 10 play, you know, in terms of a betting favorite.
Yeah. Geez, trying to pick between those two. I mean, given the fact that Rahm missed the cut last week and his first, you know, missed cut in, I guess, 22 tournaments, I think I'm more excited to see Berger.
I'm never more excited to see Berger than anybody. You know? I don't, I can't, I, he bugs me. You know that. His swing bugs me. His whole just looking at him holding the golf club bugs me.
He weighs about 8 pounds, and usually the chunk of tobacco he's got in his cheek weighs about 10. So
his left hand is so strong, it's on the side of the club, and then his right hand is so weak, it's on the other side of the club. His forearms are both like, and then he I just can't do it. And the King Daddy Topper was that boat hype video. I saw that, I was done. I was like, that's so dumb.
He was getting ready for the player impact program, right? He wants his 40 million, right?
Yeah.
Did you see the Jim Herman tweet, by the way?
No, I did not.
He sent out a tweet. Obviously, Jim Herman, you know, even though he's a PGA Tour winner, you know, not the biggest profile guy in the world. And he sends out a tweet. He's like, I can't believe they're going to pay me $40 million for this tweet. Is this how it works?
So, solid. I'll give that a like. Make sure he gets good.
So, make sure he gets maybe Berger was trying to, you know, hone up his chops there a little bit with that cheesy video for the potential $40 million.
That was a long time ago, though.
Was.
I mean, we could get into the PIP for forever, and if we think it's lasting more than 1 year, I'm taking the under. I think it's a 1 year, and then they'll move that money elsewhere to make it better. But let's get into our picks for the week. I won last week another bottle of wine. I apparently have two showing up to the house any day now. We got to ship out some hats to some folks. Nobody was able to find you in the broadcast.
Couldn't find me. I went looking.
Nobody even sent out like a bad Photoshop of you being behind Justin Thomas on the 18th tee. So we're gonna figure out a contest. We had some more TaylorMade hats to give away, so we'll figure out a contest this week. So check out Tee Talk Podcast on Instagram, where we will be giving away those hats at some point this week. But before we do, we got to get to our picks this week, Scotty. We're going to go back and forth as per usual for a bottle of wine if somebody wins. So Scott, who do you want for your first pick?
I am going to struggle with this one. I'm going to take Mark Leishman. You know what? Had a win a couple weeks ago, obviously in New Orleans. Has some experience playing in the Dallas area, and I just like Mark Leishman. I mean, any guy who has his own beer brand, I'm in for.
That's fair. I'm going Bryson. I think he finished well last week after that debacle. It's in his backyard. I'm sure he's played there a bunch. You know, he probably thinks everybody in Dallas likes him, and they probably don't. So I'm going to take Bryson.
All right. We're going to get to something really quickly here. I'm going to avoid the favorite. I'll tell you that.
I got a tie for that. Bryson's tied for a favorite right now, 9-1 with John Rahm. I hate both those odds, but.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know. Even though he's been off for a little bit, I'm gonna put Brooks in the mix. I'm gonna take a little BK action. I think he'll like his grouping for the first 2 days with Sergio and Champ.
I think so.
Well, it's hard to tell, right? I mean, it's not like he's coming out and saying, "Ooh, I love these guys."
Yeah.
But I think it's a comfortable enough pairing that I think that you know, he can go deep and get himself in position for the weekend.
All right. Well, I'm gonna keep on the Dallas train here and go Jordan. Let's pick both of them. Why not?
Why not?
Why not? There's literally no. I don't know. I couldn't. You could put up these golf holes next to any other golf course, and unless I know the other golf course, I would not be able to tell you it's from this TPC course. So no. I don't know anything about it. So I'm just kind of picking for romance here. So why not some hometown wins here for one of the two?
I don't know if I should do that or not. I'm thinking about it. I should take. No, I shouldn't. oh boy, I am struggling here. I'm gonna see. I'm double checking.
We're not gonna be watching a lot of this golf tournament.
I know, but I'm trying to double check whether certain players in the field or not. I mean, that's the other hard part here. These are the type of events where sometimes, you know, we don't end up with all the top guys because, you know, either guys love to play the week before a major or they'd like to take a week off. So, you know what? I think Willie Z gets back on the train.
Damn.
I think he gets back on the train.
Damn.
And, you know, I was going to take him before, and I
locks up his card with a win.
Yeah, I think I think he makes it happen. I really do.
Damn, that is a good. I did not see you taking that. I'm going to give out some bets before I make my pick here.
All right.
Hideki Matsuyama misses the cut. I think after everything that's gone through, give me a missed cut. I think you're going to make a little bit of money. Keith Mitchell at 61-1 after what he's just come off of.
Great value there.
Tasty. And you know what? I'm going romance all the way through. I'm picking Ricky Fowler as my last pick.
Atrocious.
Awful
He'll
pick.
He'll probably win.
He's going to win. He's going to get back into the Masters next year. Ricky, Jordan, Bryson. I hate both. I don't want to pick for anybody either of our picks except for Leishman. Yeah, this is bad. But I got to say Keith Mitchell, though. I might have to sprinkle some top 10 on Keith Mitchell after last week.
Like you said, I think that's good value. I have a question for you. How do you think Westwood's going to do this week? He's in the field.
Yeah. Who's on the bag? Is it his son? His girlfriend again?
I assume it's going to be his girlfriend.
Yeah.
She's been steady caddying for him.
I have no idea what Westwood's up to. It's these hot and colds where he's like in the mix for 5 weeks and then he disappeared after that. The PGA Championship is kind of his type of tournament that he might win. So
I don't know at Kiowa, though. It's 7,800 yards, almost 7,900.
That's true. The longest PGA champion, like longest major of all time. That's insane.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that all next week. We can't.
Yeah, we are.
We're giving away too much. So in terms of Lee, I expect him to miss the cut. There you go. There's my answer.
I'm with you on that one.
So. Yeah, I'm going to give him a miss the cut. But maybe that'll come up in the mailbag. I don't know what we got in the mailbag this week. But before we get to the mailbag, another message from our episode sponsor.
At Ping, we're an engineering company. Success is measured in the lab and on your scorecard. We focus on results, your results. In the G425 Max Driver, that means more time in the fairway, less time in the rough. It means longer drives, shorter approach shots, and fewer putts. The new G425 Drivers, taking MOI to the max. Get fit today.
Visit ca.ping.com to learn more about G425.
All right, let's get to the mailbag this week. A real variety of questions. Thanks to everyone for sending them in. Let's get rolling here. This one, I don't know. I didn't do a lot of research on this one, so you might have to throw in your two cents and what you think. But a longtime listener said, do LPGA caddies ever caddy for PGA Tour players or vice versa? Like Ryan Hoag for Paddy Tanakit at the ANA. Any stories about those who have done both?
Oh, there's hundreds.
Yeah, of course.
There was when I was at at the Greenbrier. There was a guy out there that usually caddies for Aria, and he was out there. Got hired for the week. A good caddy is going to get hired anywhere. The thing about those type of stories and why they don't come out is it's kind of just bad, you know, bad for caddies' business. I guess I was talking to a caddy. He's like, "Oh, I got an offer from PGA Tour player for 3 week stretch. I was off, you know, and." He wouldn't even name him, and he didn't even accept the job. So it happens all the time. A good player, a good caddy, will get a job anywhere. There's caddies that have been on the PGA Tour for 15 years that are out on the Korn Ferry Tour and out on the You know, if you can't get a money out on the PGA Tour, or you can't find a bag on the PGA Tour, why wouldn't you go to the LPGA? It's just as good, if not, you're going to make more money out there than the Korn Ferry Tour. And it's easier travel than going to Europe for a couple weeks and doing the European Tour. So, yeah, I think it happens all the time. I just don't have an answer of some names off the top of my head right now.
Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, you know, they're out there to work. They're out there to make money. And, you know, you don't win a lottery if you don't buy a ticket. So, you know, you know how it is. I mean, are you going to sit at home? It's going to cost some money to sit at home. So it's going to cost some money to go on the road, but at least if they go on the road, they have a chance to earn. So, definitely happens. And players or caddies will work that into their schedule too. They'll look ahead in the year and find out, okay, you know, my caddy or my player has certain weeks off. Where am I going to fill in?
You know, cool with that too. That's the other thing. Some players are, you know, not cool with that. You're my guy. I pay you a yearly salary. Actually, like I know a couple guys that literally get paid weekly, regardless of if they play or not. Right. And that's different. And that means, hey, you don't work for anyone else when we're not working. So it depends on each situation. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But good to see you. And we should mention that Ryan Hogue, who, was mentioning that question, is usually the regular caddy for our guest this week, for Marty Jurtson. He caddied for him. He calls him a caddy savant, is what he calls him. So
No one will ever call either one of us.
No, for sure. But he caddies for him in the, the PGA Professional Championship. I don't even want to get into it because the word would be so derogatory, I think, or whatever. So we both probably heard it at one time in our lives. All right, let's get on to the next one here. This one's kind of funny, actually. We might need a minute to think about this. We might not. What restaurant do you consider the Augusta National of fast food?
Now, you could take this two different directions, right? You could take this as like, it's hard to find. So when you do, it's like, I got to go there. Or you take it in, it's just the best of the best. So, you're well traveled. I'm going to let you start. And, which direction are you taking? Are you going best of the best, or like, hey, when I see it, I'm going to it?
I'm going to take it from the perspective of, if I see it, I'm there. And unfortunately, unlike Augusta National, where, all eyes are glued on Augusta National on Sundays, you'll have a tough luck going to this place on Sundays because they're not open. Mm-hmm. Chick-fil-A is my Augusta National of fast food. If I look at all the restaurants and the ones that are around, obviously there's a lot of regional stuff. But if you look at the bigger change, I think I'll go with Chick-fil-A.
All right, I think it's a good answer. I'll go the other direction. And every round at Augusta National, you know what you're going to get. You're going to love it. You're going to appreciate it. It might beat you up after all said and done. You might not feel too great. But, hey, it's comforting. And you know you want to be there. And I just got to go with McDonald's. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the meal. You can go breakfast. You can go lunch. You can go dinner. You know what you're going to get at the end of the day. And it's going to be good. It's around you. It's around every corner for a reason. If they could recreate Augusta National, every golf course could be Augusta National. Like, think of any golf course right now and they just reshape it, it's now Augusta National. Every golf course would do it, right? McDonald's, every other fast food place would switch for the money that McDonald's brings in. So
I thought you were going to talk the revenge stuff. I thought maybe Taco Bell. Taco Bell would be coming up there.
Now, Taco Bell in the States though is much better than up here.
Definitely say that. Yeah, Canada is a crapshoot, and I use that.
You never
term
know
purposefully.
It's a Walker Cup. You never know the quality you're going to get, and all the Taco Bells up in Canada are all run down. They're all like old buildings, and I went into one in like Rochester. It was Scranton. I stopped at Scranton at Taco Bell, and this place was clean and nice. And
I know that one. It was, I've been there.
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and Taco Bell sometimes is a refuge in the States. I don't know if I mentioned this one on the podcast before, but did a trip to Titleist headquarters the one time and was with Bob Weeks, Mitch Dawson from Titleist. I think Jason Logan was on that one too. And we got into Brockton, Mass, and late at night, and the only thing open in town was Taco Bell, and we were all starving, and we ate way more Taco Bell than we possibly should have. It
probably cost you like $3.
It was nothing, but I still thought it was kind of funny because we're sitting there at 11 something at night in Brockton, Mass, chucking back Taco Bell like we'd never seen it before.
Did you have a roommate on that trip?
No, thankfully. All right, on to the next one here. Do you have some tips for gaining spin bite around the green? Do you want me to tackle that one?
Well, I'll go from a less technique standpoint. I very much feel I like to just feel like my bottom hand comes through fast, but never flips. It feels wide open the whole time, almost like a putting stroke. You don't break your wrists, just feel, and then you're nipping it. You're just coming through. The butt of the head, the club, the grip is coming through first, and the club head never passes that. And it just, you're holding it off really quickly, nipping it, I guess. But I'm sure you can actually give me more of an actual, definition, the right way to do it. But that's just my feel. Yeah. That right hand is what I think about, of just making sure it never stops. It's almost like there's a board and it just comes through. Where the opposite, when you're hitting a flop shot, is all right wrist is how I feel. Like I'm almost like whipping it underneath the golf ball.
Yeah, I like that imagery that you had as far as the sensation, because really, the main things that are really happening here is, one, we need speed. As far as creating spin
you know, the factors that play in there are going to be friction, speed. Those are really key things. And friction really comes from having a clean club face, something that's not covered with all sorts of junk. You're not, don't have a moisture on there. You're obviously going to get good contact. The golf ball obviously matters. It's important that you obviously have a golf ball that's a higher performing, softer cover, higher spin. That's obviously going to be helpful. The thing that you're talking about there and that sensation of the way the club is coming through is about keeping the loft on the face. And a lot of people, unfortunately, they try to create spin by hitting down a lot. Unfortunately, if they do that, they normally take the loft off the club. So it's fine to have a descending angle of attack. That's okay. But trying to do it too much, we tend to drag the face down, and we really need to maintain that loft as much as possible. And the biggest difference that you can have between sort of that angle of attack and that loft, the bigger that is, that creates a more, we'll call it a glancing blow on the golf ball and helps create more spin. So speed's important. Loft is important. Clean club as far as, you know, being able to create a lot of friction. But yeah, that sensation that you're talking about there with that feel of that, you know, keeping that loft there where it's not sort of, you know, getting rid of that face angle, super important.
Yeah. Make sure you're practicing with the ball you use too. I've seen it so many times where somebody will grab the range balls or the balls that are on the putting green and they'll practice it and say it's rolling out. So then they lose the feel. They don't get it. And then they play the ball to actually have spin. So a little tip there.
Yeah. I had someone actually ask me about that today. They were talking about, you know, if they were going to see much difference on a, you know, personal launch monitor, if they're using a range ball versus their premium ball, and definitely you will. So, and you want to be able to be, you know, as you said, calibrated towards what's actually happening when you use those good golf balls. So, you know, making sure that you're using that consistently, super, super important. All right. This one, we're going to probably glance over this one because obviously we've talked about it a little bit, but is Rory back or is it temporary?
We never left, really. He was just jumped out of the top, 10 for the first time?
Yeah, it's number 15 right now.
I was right back. No, I think he kicked
Brooks. He was 15 last week going into this.
I don't think he ever really left. He had some struggles. Yeah. He talked about it. This is how Rory's always been. Go and look at his career. It's hot, cold, hot, cold. I wouldn't be surprised if he wins like two of the next four and then he disappears for a while. It's just kind of how he is. So, he's back, but he never left.
Yeah, you know what? 19 wins. No player is going to be Tiger Woods and be on every single week. And even Tiger wasn't on every single week. I mean, obviously, he made a lot of cuts, but, you know, he had some struggles as well. Just his struggles weren't the same as a lot of the other players. So as far as its temporary nature, yeah, that's what it's going to be. You know, 6 or 7 weeks a year is when players peak. It's hard to ask them to peak for a lot more than that. Obviously, big players like him tend to, you know, and they tend to get more good play over a longer period of time. But I don't think he's left either. It's not like he, you know, it's not like he disappeared and all of a sudden dropped below 2,000 in the world ranking. So, he never left. All right, two more here. I'm not sure what your familiarity is as far as some of the travel stuff or whatever, but what's your favorite golf course in the Myrtle Beach area? I'm planning a trip for next winter.
Whatever one Scott says, never been.
So are you telling me you've never been to Myrtle Beach?
Nah, never been.
All right.
Well,
it's a beach.
Been to Miami Beach, never been to Myrtle Beach.
Well, I'll have to solve that sometime for sure. You know what? Not as many golf courses as there used to be. Used to be well over 100 and now probably around 80 or so. But my favorite.
How do you lose 20 golf courses in like 40 years?
Real estate, my friend. You get yourself in a situation where too many golf courses have developed. There's not enough place where people can live to support the infrastructure of the town. Golf courses become very valuable very quickly. And in fact, one owner one time who sold his 54-hole facility basically told me golf for him was a 20-year plan just to hold the land is really what it was. And he got the value for it in the end.
Fair enough.
I mean, obviously overdeveloped a little bit. My favorite is down in the south end. If you head down to, you know, Pawleys Island area, Caledonia Golf and Fish Club, which is the Mike Strand's design, one of his 9 courses that he designed. Really cool golf course, 6,500 yards, par 70, you know, big mossy oaks, really cool design. I always used to say it was a combination of what you would expect from something like Augusta National and TPC Sawgrass if they had a baby. So it's a really cool place. I really enjoy it. You know, it's got the the other the southern sort of flavor as far as their, you know, their patio deck, and you can sit out there in your rocking chairs and watch players come in on 18, get these cool duck decoys for the tee offs. It's just a neat place to play. And again, 6,500 yards, you don't have to be a monster, get your way around there. Just a pretty golf course. And they have a sister course as well called True Blue. If you want to go and play a bigger golf course, more in the 7,000 yard range, but certainly not as pretty as Caledonia is. So that's my favorite. So if you're heading down to Myrtle Beach, then, you know, make sure and try and get that on your agenda. All right, last one here. This one could be interesting. How do you define a professional golfer? I see a lot of people on social media call themselves that, but never see them playing events, question mark.
Thoughts? Those people are called delusional. Yeah. A professional golfer is somebody that's trying to play golf for their profession, I think is how I would describe it. Now, there's a ton of people where you're not going to see them playing events. They might be playing smaller events, the Outlaw. Mm-hmm. Like, shout out to Alex Chayka, just won on the Champions Tour, major on the Champions Tour, which really shows how, like, nobody cares about if it's a major on the Champions Tour. It's just another event, and we didn't mention it at all.
They have 12 majors, don't they?
I don't know. Sure. There,
six? Five?
You got to tell me. I have no idea. Either way, but like he was just playing on the Outlaw Tour recently. So that's, you know, those are the type of guys where, you know, unless you see him out there, it depends where you're watching. So there's so many of professional golfers, but the social media professional golfer is a little bit different. And I wouldn't actually believe them, and they probably make more money on their actual other job than they do playing
professional golf. Generally that's always the case. I think you're right. You know, there's certainly no shortage of professional golfers that are out there, or people that are striving to be professional golfers. And if they are playing on a smaller tours and they're actually playing and competing, you know, you see a lot of people that you ask them, oh, are you a pro golfer? Yeah. How many tournaments you played last year? None. Well, that's not being a professional golfer. The other side of it too is that, you know, there's some people that are maybe doing it from an ego standpoint and they think it's cool to do. But if they're not competitive, you know, even though by definition they're somebody who's playing for money, if somebody's out there trying to make a living shooting 80, sorry, they're not good enough to turn amateur. So they shouldn't be calling themselves a professional golfer, really. I mean, technically, by definition, yes, they are. But it doesn't mean you have to believe it.
Yeah, I have a buddy that like 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, gave it a run trying to. Yeah. He probably shouldn't have. And he would say that now. And, you know, nowadays he's happy to break 80, and I was talking about, hey, you should get in this tournament, and he's like, oh, I you know, I'll sign up, but I don't know if they'll find out that I'm technically professional. I was like, did you ever make a dollar in any tournament you ever played in? He's like, no. And I was like, well, nobody cares.
You're good.
Like they probably didn't know you actually turned professional. Like nobody's flagged it.
It was probably big in their mind, you know, and maybe they were there at a time when, you know, you really had to go and get your amateur status back and the whole deal or whatever. But a lot of cases, if you haven't done anything significant, I mean, if you're just playing some event and you called yourself a pro or whatever, you know, you're blowing it up a little bit much to call yourself a professional golfer.
Like if you're playing on, what was that, like the Great Lakes Tour or whatever, and